40s. It is Member Appreciation Week. We've got lots of fun programming and events. Find more details at kaxe.org.
I think Jamaicans weren't expecting it because we've had so many close calls over the years that we sometimes don't take it as seriously as we should.
Hurricane Melissa has made landfall in Jamaica one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes in history.
For Tuesday, October 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Gun groups that cater to progressives and people of color say that they've seen a surge of interest,
particularly since last year's election.
What I'm talking about is protecting myself from a situation where there may be some kind of chaotic civil unrest.
And last night was one to remember at the World Series.
The Los Angeles Dodgers and Toronto Blue Jays played for almost 7 hours.
I've been to 2 World Series games at Dodger Stadium. They both went 18 innings.
Game 4 is tonight.
First, these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. On this 28th day of the government shutdown, the federal food aid program known as SNAP is front and center. SNAP helps tens of millions of Americans to buy food, but federal money could begin running dry this weekend if Congress does not reach a deal. Democratic-led states filed a lawsuit today seeking to force the Trump administration to use emergency money to keep it afloat. In Louisiana, officials are threatening to furlough staff who work with the program, as Mel Bridges of member station WRKF reports.
Louisiana Department of Health Secretary Bruce Greenstein said the state may have to furlough staff who work directly with SNAP or have roles supported by SNAP funding. This comes as state officials are considering alternatives to funding SNAP once federal funding runs out on November 1st. Governor Jeff Landry declared a state of emergency over the lack of SNAP funding last week. He asked the legislature to approve state money to cover benefits to children, the elderly, and the disabled through November. The state Senate is expected to vote on the measure Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm Mel Bridges in Baton Rouge.
The government shutdown has air traffic controllers facing more pressure. NPR's Joel Rose reports that today marks the first time controllers officially receive no money on payday.
Air traffic controllers are still required to come to work during the shutdown without pay. Controllers say that's making an already difficult job even harder. Joe Segreto handles air traffic around New York City, some of the most complex airspace in the world.
The pressure is real. We have people trying to keep these airplanes safe. We have trainees trying to learn a new job that is very fast-paced, very stressful, very complex, now having to worry about how they're going to pay bills.
The controllers' union says hundreds have had to take on second jobs to make ends meet. And some controllers are taking their message directly to the public, handing out leaflets at more than a dozen airports and urging Congress to end the shutdown. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The layoffs Amazon announced today shaping up to be the biggest wave of white-collar job cuts in the company's history. Amazon is laying off 14,000 corporate employees as it spends big on the AI race, as NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Amazon says it's cutting about 4% of its corporate workforce. A note to employees cites a goal of, quote, reducing bureaucracy, removing layers, and shifting resources to ensure we're investing in our biggest bets. The company has faced intense pressure from investors to tighten its finances. In part, that's because it overhired during the coronavirus pandemic, and in part because it's so far delivered disappointing growth of its AI business in the race against Microsoft and other rivals. A note that Amazon is among NPR's recent financial support. CEO Andy Jassy in June wrote to employees that generative AI would mean fewer corporate workers in the next few years. The company will deliver its latest financial report on Thursday. Alina Seluk, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. Hundreds of thousands are without power in Jamaica, where Hurricane Melissa made landfall today. Melissa has weakened somewhat, but the storm remains a powerful Category 4 hurricane, packing 145-mile-per-hour winds. The National Hurricane Center says ongoing flash flooding and landslides will continue through the night, and that Melissa will remain a major hurricane as it moves toward Cuba. The U.S. has carried out more deadly strikes on alleged drug boats in the eastern Pacific. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the strikes were launched yesterday and that 4 boats were destroyed. 14 people were killed, 1 survivor was rescued by Mexican search and rescue teams. There's a new $50 million fund for literary arts. It's a collaboration between seven philanthropic foundations, including the MacArthur Foundation, which supports NPR. As NPR's Andrew Limbong reports, this fund could be a lifeline for literary programs hit by cuts to federal funding.
Many of those federal cuts are in legal limbo, and so this new fund, called the Literary Arts Fund, will be welcome news for small independent presses, writing retreat programs, book festivals, and more. Elizabeth Alexander is a writer, poet, and the president of the Mellon Foundation, which initiated the coalition of groups pooling money for the fund.
The literary arts are tremendously, tremendously underfunded and can make a little bit go a very long way.
Alexander says the fund was in the process of coming together well before federal spending cuts and hopes the grant money can outlast the ups and downs of government funding for the arts. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
And I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered Radio, KAXC. This week, we are celebrating you, the people who make this station possible. Listeners, donors, volunteers who have kept us going strong, especially after the loss of federal funding. You can find more info about some of our events this week at KAXC.org. One of those events will be at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter on Thursday from 4 to 6. Chat with KAXC staff and other members while enjoying a pint.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. We begin this hour with Hurricane Melissa. The massive Category 5 hurricane was packing 185-mile-an-hour winds as it made landfall in Jamaica, and it is likely to set records. NPR's Eder Peralta is following this story from his base in Mexico. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Hey, Eder. So tell us, where did the storm make landfall?
So the National Hurricane Center says this storm came in near the town of New Hope, which is on the southwestern coast of Jamaica. But the big headline here is that this is a monster storm, and that's not just some superlative we're using. This is history. The National Hurricane Center says this is one of the most powerful storms to ever make landfall in the Atlantic Basin. Hurricane Melissa continued to strengthen right up until landfall. When it hit land, it had howling winds and a central pressure of 892 millibars. And I mention central pressure because the lower the pressure, the stronger the storm. Meteorologists say only six other storms on record have had a pressure lower than 900 millibars. And all of this is preliminary, but this storm will go down in history. According to meteorologist Brian McNulty of the University of Miami, this may well challenge a nearly 100-year-old severity record in the Atlantic.
Wow, okay. I mean, I know it's still pretty early, but what are we hearing from the island?
I mean, the only good news in all of this is that the storm went west, and Kingston, which is the biggest population center in the country, will not bear the brunt of this storm. In fact, our producer in Kingston was out on the streets as the storm made landfall. He's seen very little water, and the wind hasn't been terrible. He found people milling about. Rachel Severa, a resident there, said that even though Jamaicans are in the middle of the Caribbean, this storm seemed to catch them by surprise.
I think Jamaicans weren't expecting it because we've had so many close calls over the years that we sometimes don't take it as seriously as we should. But I think the western side of the country is going to feel it.
And she's right. The National Hurricane Center says we should expect catastrophic damage from this storm. In the area around the eye, in the western part of this country, the wind speeds are as bad as those in tornadoes.
Eder, what are we hearing at this point from the Jamaican government, and what can you tell us about the aid effort?
The Jamaican government had been urging people to evacuate. Overnight, about 6,000 people did get to shelters. In a press conference, Government Minister Desmond McKenzie said that they are getting calls from hard-hit areas, from people who are asking for transportation to shelters. But he says at this point, the government can't get people out because the effects of the storm are already being felt.
We are having reports of widespread impact across several parishes, which are seeing increased number of land slippage, flooding, fire, storm surge, and power outage.
The government expects that when all this is done, about 50,000 people will be displaced. But they say they're ready, that as soon as the storm passes, they have crews who will begin clearing roads, who will begin trying to restore power. The government says that it expects the international airport in Kingston to be reopened by Thursday. And that's important because that's going to be one of the main ways to get aid onto the island.
And Ader, just briefly, where is Hurricane Melissa headed?
Look, it's over Montego Bay now, and it's going to hit the northern part of Jamaica, obviously. And then the storm is expected to make landfall again in eastern Cuba, somewhere near Guantanamo Bay.
NPR's Ader Peralta reporting from his base in Mexico City. Ader, thank you so much.
Thank you, Juana.
Hours before President Biden left office, he signed a number of preemptive pardons. And those pardons went to the House committee investigating January 6th. These are preemptive pardons for people like Dr. Anthony Fauci, General Mark Milley. In a statement, Biden had said that he wanted to shield these people from, quote, unjustified and politically motivated prosecutions from the incoming Trump White House. Well, since entering office, President Trump has declared on social media that Biden's pardons are invalid, claiming without evidence that the Biden administration used a writing machine called an auto pen to sign those pardons without Biden's knowledge. Trump's statement does not have the force of law, and Biden has repeatedly insisted that he was personally behind all the decisions made during his presidency. But today, the House Oversight Committee, chaired by Republican Congressman James Comer, asked the Justice Department to look into what they call the, quote, Biden auto pen presidency. Attorney General Pam Bondi says her team is doing exactly that. To talk more about this, we're joined now by Mark Osler. He's a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, known for his work on clemency. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this House Oversight Committee accuses the Biden White House of covering up Biden's cognitive decline. Let me just ask you, what does this report ultimately ask for?
Well, it's asking for a further investigation by the Department of Justice. I think they were frustrated because some of the witnesses pled the fifth, and there's a political point being made as well.
Okay, and just to remind everyone, this is a Republican-led committee. What do you make of the argument that they lay out in this report about Biden's cognitive decline and the permanence of these preemptive pardons?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on cognition, but I am an expert on clemency, and I can tell you that the Constitution doesn't make any requirement whatsoever as to how a pardon or a commutation is going to be put into writing or issued at all. And we've seen a variety of methods used over the years. You know, in 2005, the Office of Legal Counsel provided the president with advice that the president could use an auto pen to sign bills. Obviously, one of the most important things a president is going to sign. And since then, presidents have used auto pens for a wide variety of things,
right,
especially when there's a lot to be signed at once.
Well, what can the Department of Justice actually do in this situation? Like, can you think of any time a pardon from a president has been reversed or declared null and void, as this House committee and President Trump would like to see happen here?
No, that hasn't happened. Once a president issues pardon, it's been viewed as final. And so if something was to get overturned here, this would really be breaking new ground.
So are you telling me that a president's pardon power is absolute?
It's surprising, but that's what it says in the Constitution. It's almost absolute. It can't cover people who are under impeachment. And it's generally accepted that it can't pardon future crimes, that is, those that haven't been committed yet. But yes, it's really rare in having so few checks and balances.
Well, then, okay, say you're a person who did receive a pardon from President Biden. What would you advise that person to do to protect themselves legally now from having that pardon reversed or somehow invalidated during the Trump administration?
Yeah, there's really not that much that they can do. I think most people who have studied this would be shocked if a pardon was overturned. One of the things that I really fear that could happen with this investigation and some of the conclusions that they seem to want to reach is you have 37 people who received a commutation of their death sentence by President Biden. And I would really think it would cause a constitutional crisis if President Trump moved to execute those people despite that commutation of the death sentence. But going forward, I hope that pardons aren't undermined. They're under enough stress as they are.
Mark Osler from the University of St. Thomas, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Last night's marathon game 3 of the World Series was epic. The Los Angeles Dodgers and the Toronto Blue Jays played for almost 7 hours for a record-tying 18 innings. The game ended in a dramatic home run for the Dodgers, and LA now leads the series 2-1. Steve Futterman reports.
For the hardy souls who stuck it out at Dodger Stadium last night for all 6 hours and 39 minutes, this was their reward. Listen carefully. You can ever so slightly hear a crack of the bat. As the ball soars to center field, the crowd gets louder. One man yells, "Come on, baby." Then elation as it sails over the fence. At Dodger Stadium, they immediately started playing the song "I Love LA," which they do after every Dodger win. This was the call on ESPN Radio.
At the track, gone! Freddie Freeman! A home run to center field. Freeman walks it off in the 18th.
The 18 innings equaled the longest World Series game ever. Ironically, the other one also took place here in 2018. As last night's game kept going and going and going, fans like Joel Delgado knew they were witnessing something special.
No, I think I'm getting double my money. And it's in the World Series, so I have no complaints at all. Edge of my seat to where I'm kind of tired and a little sore, but other than that, there's no complaints. I can't complain.
He stayed the entire game, but as it went on, some fans gave up, like Wilbur Chu.
Yes, we're leaving now.
Why?
We got work tomorrow, and we gotta get home, go to bed. I'm hoping they're winning. We're gonna listen to them when we drive home. So.
As the victory celebration continued, Ted Humphrey was taking it all in. He may have been unique among the 52,000 fans. He's only been to 2 World Series games, the 2 longest ever.
I've been to 2 World Series games at Dodger Stadium. They both went 18 innings.
It's remarkable.
It's the only 2 I've ever been to.
Beyond the length, this game set all sorts of records. The Dodgers' great Shohei Ohtani got on base 9 times, 2 home runs, 2 doubles, and 5 walks. It also featured the most players ever used in a series game, 46, including the most pitchers, 18, and the most strikeouts, 34. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the World Series in Los Angeles.
Dodgers. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxc.org. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Mostly cloudy tonight, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40, and for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, and then lows tomorrow night in the low to mid 30s. Looking ahead to Thursday, cloudy, highs in the upper 40s. It is Member Appreciation Week here at KAXC. We're taking some time to thank the people that make this radio service possible. You stepped up in a big way this summer when we lost our federal funding. We can't thank you enough. We're going to try, though. We've got some fun events happening throughout the week. We hope you can swing by either KAXC in Grand Rapids or KBXC in Bemidji on Halloween. This Friday, we'll be handing out candy during business hours to old and young. We hope to see you. Also, this Saturday, we have a special Kids Green Cheese airing from 6 to 7 before the main event. Mike Spry will be your host, along with youngsters Mia and Alex, who are working hard on their green cheese questions for kids. Again, that is this Saturday from 6 to 7. Brainerd Community Theatre presents Dracula, a comedy of terrors, now through November 1st at the Chalberg Theatre on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find more information at clcperformingarts.com. And the Marcel Family Center has a Halloween bash this Friday night, 5 to 7:30. Families can enjoy food, games, candy, and more.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For decades, the image of gun ownership in America was white, rural, and Republican. Well, that has been changing, according to gun clubs, trainers, Second Amendment advocates, and researchers. They say more liberals, people of color, and LGBTQ people have been buying guns for years, especially since last year's election. NPR's Frank Langfitz spoke with some of them to find out why. His story was based on more than 30 interviews. And a warning, it includes the sound of gunfire.
Charles grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in the middle of housing projects. This is back in the 70s. His mother, deeply religious, forbid guns of any kind.
So I couldn't even play with a water gun. And I remember vividly summertime when my friends would have water gun fights and I couldn't participate.
Charles, who's black, now works as a doctor in Maryland. He comes to this shooting range to practice every week with his new gun.
This is a Smith & Wesson 380, and then my next gun will be a Glock, I already have a shotgun.
Charles said he decided to buy a gun after the Trump administration did things that scared him. The arrest of a foreign student who criticized her university's policy on Israel, the handcuffing of a U.S. senator. Charles worries ordinary citizens like him could eventually be targeted.
What I'm talking about is protecting myself from a situation where there may be some kind of chaotic civil unrest and the streets become something we don't recognize.
And that civil unrest that you expect would be triggered by the president or the administration through rhetoric?
He has it all. He could dispatch citizens or the government. It doesn't matter. He could do both. And I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen. What I'm saying is none of this is out of the question any longer.
Charles and some others interviewed for this story asked to be identified only by their first names. They fear retaliation from the Trump administration. Charles has a 19-year-old daughter named Charlie. She's on the taller side and joins her dad for gun training each week.
I need to practice my headshots. Because of my height, it does make it harder.
Charlie says she fears for her safety because of her race and gender. The day after the election, a man drove onto her college campus and hurled racial slurs at black students.
Some people, they hate us so much that they really try to make it known how much we're not wanted here.
You mean black people?
Yes, especially. Black people, women, and also I feel like who's targeted now is just liberals because of Trump's second term.
White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson dismissed NPR's reporting for this story as, quote, disingenuous and biased, and a reason why the network no longer receives federal funding. President Trump has blamed what he calls the radical left for political violence. He cited his near assassination last year and the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk.
It's long past time for all Americans and the media to confront the fact that violence and murder are the tragic consequence of demonizing those with whom you disagree day after day, year after year, in the most hateful and despicable way possible. For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals.
Many liberals who spoke to NPR say it's the president who demonizes others, whether it be undocumented immigrants.
They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done.
Or political opponents.
We pledge to you that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, that lie and steal and cheat on elections, and will do anything possible. They'll do anything, whether legally or illegally, to destroy America and to destroy the American dream.
I'm David Phillips, and I'm on the training team for the Liberal Gun Club.
The Liberal Gun Club has chapters in more than 30 states. It provides a haven for liberals to train and learn about guns.
Since the second inauguration of Trump, we have seen an incredible increase in interest in training with firearms. The concern is about the supporters of the right wing who feel that they have been given permission to run roughshod, at least, if not commit outright violence against people they don't like.
Phillips says club membership has grown by two-thirds since November, from 2,700 members to 4,500. Requests for training have quintupled. Gun clubs with similar memberships say they've been seeing the same thing.
Hey, folks, as everyone knows, there's been a huge surge in fear and panic since the election, and we've been booked out to September for individuals wanting to take our Pistol 101 class.
We have seen an increase of membership across our chapters of around 40%.
I've never seen a surge like this before.
That was Tom Nguyen, who runs the L.A. Progressive Shooters Gun Club, speaking just a few weeks after Trump's inauguration, followed by a woman named Hope, who helps lead the Socialist Rifle Association, and Thomas Boyer, with the San Francisco chapter of the Pink Pistols. Their motto, armed gays don't get bashed. Even traditional Second Amendment groups acknowledge more liberals are seeking gun training out of fear. Taylor Rhodes works with the National Association for Gun Rights.
It's definitely common knowledge at this point. I think we saw a little bit of it, you know, right after the first Trump inauguration.
There's no way to measure just how many people are buying guns because the political environment scares them. But the phrase, how do I buy a gun, spiked a number of times in the last year, according to Google Trends. The spikes came around the time of Trump's election, his inauguration, the first immigration enforcement blitz in January, and the day when Trump held a military parade in Washington, D.C. David Yamani is a professor of sociology at Wake Forest University. He says the nation's volatile politics have been driving more liberals and minorities to buy guns for some time.
We definitely saw something similar happening in the COVID year of 2020, where we rolled straight from the pandemic into the summer of the George Floyd murder protests, and then rolling straight from there into a contested presidential election. And there we do have some data. We do know that in that year that new gun owners were disproportionately African-American. They were disproportionately female.
Gun ownership among liberals has been on the rise long before Trump's reelection. In 2022, a University of Chicago study found that 29% of Democrats or Democrat-leaning people nationwide had a gun at home. That's 7 percentage points higher than a dozen years earlier. Like the vast majority of gun owners, those who spoke to NPR said they would only use the weapons for self-protection and would not engage with law enforcement. MJ is a member of a liberal self-defense group in the Midwest.
All the language that we use is absolutely not about rallying together to arm and go assault anyone at all. Absolutely not. If anyone even talks like that, I or someone else would probably boot them out of the group.
Bill Sack is with the Second Amendment Foundation, which challenges gun control legislation. He says he's glad to see more liberals exercising their rights to self-defense. But he has a caveat.
Is it a good thing that people are scared? No, of course not.
Every new gun owner NPR interviewed for this story said they thought it was highly unlikely they would have to defend themselves because of civil unrest. But they also said if they ever had to, they'd regret not having a gun. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. Thank you for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock, your On the River host is Sarah Sarah. She will be bringing you a great mix of music. Weather for tonight, cloudy, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 47 to 51 with light north wind.
For KAXC News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Minnesota is among a coalition of 25 states suing the Trump administration for suspending SNAP benefits. Over 400,000 Minnesotans receive Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program funds. As the government shutdown drags on, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says it will be out of funds for SNAP benefits starting next month. But Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison and the other plaintiffs say that the USDA is illegally suspending benefits. They point to billions in SNAP-specific contingency funds that have long been set aside by Congress. A news release from Ellison says the Trump administration is making a deliberate, illegal, and inhumane choice to not fund SNAP. He says Trump's USDA is, quote, using hungry children as bargaining chips in the fight over the government shutdown. Democrats have blocked Republican bills to temporarily fund the government. Leaders say they want Republicans to negotiate on a bipartisan compromise for expiring health insurance tax credits. A politicized notice posted earlier this week on the USDA website blamed Senate Democrats for the suspension of benefits. Pequot Lakes-based Lakes Area Food Shelf has announced it will open a branch to serve Brainerd and Baxter. The announcement comes as food shelves across the state brace themselves for increased need. Chelsea Perkins shares the details.
The organization says the decision to pursue expansion comes from discussions with Brainerd area nonprofits aimed at addressing growing food insecurity. According to data collected by the food shelf, nearly 200 households served are from Brainerd and Baxter, compared to about 120 from Pequot. Tammy Larson is the director of the food shelf. She says area healthcare organizations serving communities across north central Minnesota send their low-income patients there as well.
Right now, about 38% of our shoppers are coming from Brainerd and further. To go to a food shelf that has nutrient-dense food, that has good hours, but also is like a no-questions-asked. We serve everybody who needs food.
For many people, this means a round trip of 50 miles or more.
It's too hard to see those shoppers traveling so far with cars that aren't necessarily dependable. They don't necessarily have the gas money. Many of them will leave their car running for fear that it might not start.
Currently, the Salvation Army operates the only food shelf in Brainerd. The food shelf there limits visits to once every 30 days, according to the organization's website. Lakes Area Food Shelf is in the process of finalizing a space with the cost of expansion estimated to be $1.7 million. A target date for opening the new facility is early April 2026. Visit KAXC.org for more information on how to get involved. Chelsea Perkins, KAXC News.
Governor Tim Walz announced Monday additional state support for Minnesota food shelves with SNAP aid close to running out. But he warns it won't be enough, and aid groups have tips for people organizing to help in their communities. It's expected that already stressed food shelves will see even more demand. Stephanie De La Hose of the group Move for Hunger says if you're inspired to mobilize your neighbors and collect items, it's best to call the local food shelf first and see what's needed.
Your local food pantry might have just gotten a huge donation of boxed mashed potatoes, and you might think you're doing something great by putting together all these sides for Thanksgiving and asking people for boxed mashed potatoes, but that's not really the need.
Standard best practices still apply, including gathering or donating non-perishable food items or giving money directly to the food shelf. That way, the staff has more purchasing power for items like fresh produce and meat. De La Hose says if you have the means and are planning a major buy at a grocery store, it's still better to donate the money because your dollars won't stretch as far. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. Upper Red Lake walleye anglers will be allowed a 4-fish possession limit this winter, with one walleye longer than 17 inches allowed. The open water limit was 5 fish this year, but the DNR says it's dropping the bag limit to 4 because the winter fishery is so popular. Fall netting showed the walleye population is in excellent shape, and the lake is full of fish of all sizes. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features with Begonia, starring Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, now playing in select theaters, in theaters everywhere, October 31st. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. If you are stoked to see a new song on Spotify from your favorite artist, beware. It might just be AI impersonating a real musician. NPR's Bobby Allen joins us now to discuss another way artificial intelligence is creeping into our lives. Hey.
Hey, Juana.
So, Bobby, I understand this is happening on Spotify, but also on other music platforms. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, you know, this first came to my attention after seeing this Los Angeles musician Luke Temple post about it on social media. He was in a band called Here We Go Magic, and they have not released music since 2015. But on Monday morning, he was flooded with a bunch of confusing messages. Here is Temple.
I just woke up to somebody, like, DM'd me on Instagram and was like, apparently, Here We Go Magic just released a new track, Sure doesn't sound like you. And so I looked, and lo and behold, there it was. And it's just like, I mean, it's not fooling anybody. It doesn't sound anything like me or the band.
And that's because it is AI, a song that says it is Temple's band and appears on Temple's band's Spotify page as a new release, but he had nothing to do with it.
Interesting. Okay, so Luke Temple says this AI song, it sounds nothing like his band, but Bobby, what do you think?
Nothing. I mean, there's absolutely no way that anyone would confuse the AI band with his band, but let's take a listen. Here, here is Here We Go Magic, followed by the AI song. She's on another ship. And here's the AI one.
I know just how to whisper your melody on the breeze.
So, not much similarity there, Juana, no. I would say. I don't think that would fool any of Temple's fans, but it sure did annoy him. Here's what he thought about it.
It's so predatory and so terrible. Like, I mean, whatever. It's not like it's not like I'm losing any money over it. It's just like the principle of it's just so awful.
Well, I mean, Bobby, is this common? How often is this happening?
Yeah, I talked to people inside the music industry, other musicians, producers, and record label people, and they all said, yes, this is a growing problem. Earlier this year, Wilco singer Jeff Tweedy's former band had an AI song pop up on its Spotify page. The country music singer Blaze Foley, who died in 1989, had a new AI song appear. It's happening more and more. And Spotify, when I reached out to them, said, you know, they're building new defenses against this. They said they took down 75 million spammy songs last year, and many of them were made with AI.
Okay, we got to back up for a second here. I don't understand how this is happening at all. Could you or I just upload a song saying I'm, for example, Beyonce or Taylor Swift, and then it'll just show up on their Spotify page?
Yeah, it's really confusing, right? I had the same question. And for really big artists, so the Taylor Swifts and Beyoncés of the world, it's not possible. There are special guardrails for top musicians. But for artists who have died and indie bands that are no longer active, it is possible to make an AI song with an AI generator, upload it to Spotify using a third-party distribution tool, you'd think it would be instantly caught and taken down, but Juana, AI music has gotten so sophisticated that these automatic detection tools are being tricked. Huh. Temple, the Los Angeles musician, told me he thinks it's about making a few bucks, that if these AI spammers do this on a mass scale, that maybe they can make some money, you know, one fraction of a cent at a time.
NPR's Bobby Allen, thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
After more than 500 days under siege, the Sudanese army's last stronghold in Darfur, the city of El Fasher, has fallen to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The RSF has previously been accused of genocide by the U.S., and as Kate Bartlett reports, there have already been reports of atrocities and ethnic cleansing since they overran the city on Sunday.
The RSF has been celebrating a major battlefield victory.
Allahu Akbar!
General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who heads the Sudanese armed forces, admitted government troops had left the city after their base was overrun by the paramilitary. After 2.5 years of civil war, the RSF and allied Arab militias now control all of Darfur, the remote western region where their forebears, the Janjaweed, perpetrated a genocide against mainly African ethnic groups some 2 decades ago. Now there are well-founded fears that history is about to repeat itself. Videos already circulating amongst monitoring and human rights groups, which NPR cannot independently verify, show grinning militiamen shooting detainees and chasing fleeing civilians while shouting racial slurs.
What this points to is that the genocide that we saw 20 years ago is actually still continuing.
Khalid Hare, a Sudanese analyst, says there's potential for more violence this time round. It's already started.
Satellite imagery shows us that the RSF is going house to house in some neighborhoods of El Fasher in cleansing operations. And expert analysts think that they can see the bloodstains from space.
Shayna Lewis is Sudan specialist with advocacy group Avaaz. She says early estimates indicate at least 1,000 civilians have already been killed.
I appreciate your efforts to update the news about El Fasher.
One of these was Mohamed Duda, a spokesperson for the Zamzam displacement camp near El Fasher, who survived an attack on the camp by the RSF in April, where they slaughtered hundreds. He's spoken to NPR before and was in touch as recently as last week.
I'm so glad to be in touch with you. I will share with you every day news update if you want.
Now he's dead. RSF fighters, blatantly unconcerned about chances of future prosecution, frequently film their crimes and post them on the internet, Lewis says.
Residents of El Fasher who previously left the city are finding out about the deaths of their loved ones through footage of executions that are widely circulating on social media.
The war over which side gets to run the resource-rich nation that sits at the vital crossroads between the Sahel, the Horn of Africa, and the Red Sea has killed tens of thousands and displaced 14 million. Both sides have been accused of atrocities. But it has not been happening in a vacuum. There are multiple international players involved. The United Arab Emirates is accused of backing the RSF, something the UAE denies.
This victory for the RSF allows it to consolidate total control over one-third of the country, all of Darfur.
The taking of El Fasher will only give it more leverage, says Cameron Hudson, former special envoy to Sudan.
That will bolster its claims that it's a government and demand greater and better treatment for itself at any future negotiating table.
With the latest RSF gain, there's a possibility the country could split, not just in half, but into numerous territories. In the meantime, the RSF appears intent on pursuing a scorched-earth policy in El Fasher, a city of some 250,000 people, with the real extent of the atrocities likely only to become clear in the weeks ahead. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Farmers are increasingly posting in online marketplaces or taking out personal ads to find buyers for their land. Programs in several states help farmers do this when they don't have a relative or a friend to pass their farm on to. Sophia Salaby of member station WKAR reports.
For most of his adult life, Thomas Lodge has been involved in agriculture, studying botany, creating a mushroom wholesale business, and building an organic farm outside of Detroit. A few years ago, he wanted to focus on his mushroom business full time, but didn't want to completely give up the farm.
I kind of built up the brand and was in some markets and got the organic certification. So I was really looking for somebody that kind of shared the same vision as me.
So he made a post on an online platform in Michigan called My Farm Link, which connects landowners with farm seekers, and found Simon Yevzelman. He and his wife wanted to launch new livelihoods in agriculture and were excited about finding Lodge's property.
It's one in a billion that a turnkey farm was available 30 minutes from our door in Dearborn Heights.
This is the second year the Yevzelmans have grown vegetables, flowers, mushrooms, and herbs to sell to customers on the land that they lease from Lodge.
This bed is green onion and lettuce that are just coming in. We've got carrot, two more beds of radish, got some snap peas.
My FarmLink program manager, Jill Doner, says the way Lodge and the Yevzelmans found each other is becoming more common.
Historically speaking, farmers used to just give their land to their sons or their daughters, and they would take over the operation. That's not happening anymore.
She says that issue is exacerbated as more of the country's farmers get older. And she says for many of them, the land they own is like a piece of them, which makes passing it on, especially to someone new, a tough personal process.
Most farmers want that land to go to a deserved farmer, somebody who can actually, you know, take it and do good for the land.
My Farm Link aims to make that initial introduction easier. Yevzelman says the concept is easy to grasp.
It's great. It's just like any other online marketplace where people can share, you know, supply and demand.
On the website, people share what they're looking for, whether it's land for sale or lease or a mentorship. And then they inject a little personality into their posts, like this one, small town gardening girl looking to expand her farm. Or there's another about a family of grow-getters who are looking to farm around and find out. The concept behind these programs, what's known as land or farm linking, goes back several decades. Shemariah Blum-Evitz is the executive director for Land for Good, which manages a farm linking program in New England. It launched more than a decade ago.
We're not growing any more land. So maintaining what we have available and making sure it continues to be there for future generations is going to be really key.
There are currently several dozen farm linking programs active in more than 30 states. After operating in several individual counties in Michigan, My Farm Link is going statewide this month, with more than 300 farm seekers already signed up. One of them is Maureen McComb, who wants to farm for the first time.
I kind of feel like farming has been like this well-kept secret, like kind of passed down from generations. And if you're not in it, it's really hard to figure out how to break in it.
Her dream property for her family, several acres where they can grow produce and flowers and maybe raise some goats and chickens. McComb says she's in the early stages of connecting with a farmer that will hopefully get her closer to that dream. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Salaby in East Lansing.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 5:48. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear our album of the week. And at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Weather for tonight, cloudy, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs 47 to 51 with light north wind. Lows tomorrow night, low to mid 30s, and looking ahead to Thursday, cloudy with highs in the upper 40s. You can answer our question of the week. We want to hear about your favorite Halloween costumes from the past. Send photos if you have them. And you can also tell us about your favorite or not so favorite candy. Text us 218-326-1234. We are celebrating our members this week. You stepped up big time when our federal funding was cut this summer, and we haven't forgotten it. This is all about saying thank you for keeping us on the air, keeping us going strong. We have many events going on throughout the week, some special programming too. Tomorrow it is Public Radio Music Day. We will have a musical Green Cheese going on from noon to one with Malachi Coons and myself. And then tomorrow evening, we've got two fun events. From 6 to 8, we'll be at Bridget's Pub in Bemidji for Guess the Groove. You can join KBXC staff for a really fun musical game. And also, at that very same time, 6 to 8, we'll be at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids for Judge That Jam. Listen to some new songs and let us know what you think. Also, tomorrow we'll have a special On the River at this time.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. A Paris fashion landmark for nearly two centuries is at the center of a city fight, thanks to the arrival of a Chinese retail giant. Here's NPR's Rebecca Rossman.
Nearly 170 years ago, a young shopkeeper named Xavier Ruel set up a small store in the center of Paris. His idea was simple: good quality at fair prices. That little shop grew into a city landmark, the Bazaar de l'Hôtel de Ville, or BHV. But here inside the eight-story department store, a new arrival is stirring outrage. The Chinese ultra-fast fashion giant Shein is set to open its first permanent boutique here on November 1st. Marie Cosson, a longtime customer, tells me she's disgusted by the move and will boycott not just Shein, but all of BHV. The store has sold its soul to the devil, she says, and she came in to say goodbye to the staff. In 2023, BHV was bought by a property group called Société des Grands Magasins, the same company bringing Shein into several Galeries Lafayette department stores around France. Some French brands have already packed up and left in protest. Others are starting a movement. Across town, in the 11th arrondissement, a crowd has gathered at the opening night for La Maison des Autres Modes, a new headquarters for a collective of designers and activists promoting sustainable fashion. Aria Levy runs the show here. A petition she launched opposing Shein's arrival has topped 100,000 signatures.
We're in the center of Paris. I mean, it's just, it's enough. It's enough. We have to say enough. And people have to say we don't want to stand for this.
That frustration has also reached City Hall. Florentin Letissier, deputy mayor for sustainability and waste reduction, says Paris can't claim to be green while welcoming Shein.
Puisque Shein, ça représente pour nous l'ultra fast fashion.
For us, Shein represents ultra fast fashion. It's a model we must fight. These are cheap clothes made in modern slavery conditions. It's bad for the planet, and it's bad for Parisian designers.
Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo went further, calling the move, quote, a betrayal of Paris's values. In June, the French Senate passed a bill that would ban ads for ultra-fast fashion brands, fine influencers who promote them, and add an eco-tax of up to 10 euros per garment by 2030. Regulators also fined Shein 40 million euros for misleading discounts. Shein didn't respond directly to multiple allegations about the company, including claims about its labor practices and design theft. But in a statement, the company said its partnership with BHV, quote, represents an opportunity to experiment with new ways of combining our industry-leading on-demand model with offline retail. In an upmarket French fashion shop called Paul and Joe, just off the swanky Boulevard Saint-Germain, Marie-Emmanuelle Demerol, the CEO, is showing me fashion that is anything but fast. She picks up a tailored coat.
You can see there. This is special buttons that were made by hand, one by one.
Shein, she says, has no such craftsmanship, adding the brand has built a reputation for stealing designs.
They steal from anyone, any brand, so they don't respect human, they don't respect the earth, and they don't respect the creativity.
Thibault Ledunois is director of innovation at the French Fashion Council, which represents ready-to-wear labels like Paul and Joe. He points out that Shein has already expanded into home goods, cosmetics, and accessories.
Their strategy is to become the supermarket of the world, and this is what we have to be really aware of.
Which may be why, nearly 170 years after Xavier Ruel opened his little shop for quality goods at fair prices, Parisians are still fighting to keep his dream alive. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
Americans are willing to spend on magic this October. Surveys find that despite economic concerns and worries about tariffs, U.S. shoppers are expected to drop a record amount for Halloween. NPR's Alina Selyuk talked to some enthusiasts who have found a few savings tricks.
The Halloween takeover of Lin Nguyen's house just outside Chicago started slowly. One year, the front got cocooned in spider webs. Then the yard grew tombstones and skeleton parts.
And then it just kind of went from one thing to another.
Evil little witches. Creepy crawling monsters.
And then naturally, you know, you got to put the spotlights, you got to add like arcs.
Pumpkins, obviously, a floating phantom, and the modern classic, the 12-foot skeleton. This year's edition has spread to the roof.
Kind of mimicking that skeleton just crawling out of your house.
Nguyen's $200 skeleton is part of this year's rise in Halloween spending. Last year, this spending declined for the first time since the pandemic as people tightened their belts. But now, the National Retail Federation forecasts a new record, more than $13 billion to be spent on candy, costumes, decorations. One reason for this higher spending is simply higher prices. But there's also the quest for joy, even on a careful budget.
We are being mindful, but not to the point where we wanted to, like, give up our Halloween tradition just yet.
Laura Knapp from Baltimore is mainly splurging on candy, expecting hundreds of trick-or-treaters that swarm their neighborhood.
We have three, like, giant Costco candy bags so far, and we're thinking, like, we might need another one.
Federal data shows the price of chewing gum and candy went up nearly 10% from last year, mainly because of a global cocoa shortage. It's now in its third year. Knapp's husband has been out of work because of the government shutdown, so they are thinking about their finances. But they also have little kids, 6 and 3 years old. And having that memorable evening for them with friends and neighbors is a big deal.
As of right now, we just, you know, want to make the magic for, like, our kids and the kids in the neighborhood.
And so she says maybe they'll have to skip on takeout from DoorDash to compensate.
But we're making sure that we get the big old bags of candy.
Knapp's tried and true way to save money is reusing. A thrifted sweater shapeshifts into a costume, then back into a regular sweater. The candy chute that launches treats down the porch steps, she handmade it during the social distancing years of the pandemic, and now it's a local attraction.
We literally have kids come up going, "It's the candy snake house."
Both Knapp and Nguyen offer another savings tip, which is to plan for next Halloween on this Halloween. Buy your decorations 1 year out.
When Halloween is technically, like, over, they're selling them off for 50% off, 60% off.
Nguyen says he was always into the spooky holiday, but it was when he had children and then bought his house that he decided it was time to gourd big or gourd home.
It's like one of those upfront costs. It's a little expensive, but ideally, I don't have to spend any more moving forward, right? It's just an investment that just kind of gets rebuilt every year.
An investment that he feels pays a good dividend in a parade of spellbound faces stopping by. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features with Begonia. Two conspiracy-obsessed young men kidnap the CEO of a company convinced that she is an alien intent on destroying Earth. Now playing in select theaters, in theaters everywhere October 31st. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. nprwineclub.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio. You can contribute by texting the word donate to 218-326-1234. It is Member Appreciation Week. We've got lots going on. You can find a full schedule at KAXE.org. We want to say thank you for your support. Coming up next, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Cloudy tonight, chance of rain, low 30.